Well, hey there, record collectors and vinyl fans. Welcome to yet another episode of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for fans and collectors of vinyl records. This week is part two of our two-part interview with John Tefteller, blues record collector extraordinaire. Last week, John told us all about his record collection, some 400,000 records in inventory, as well as his personal collection, many of the rare, one-of-a-kind blues records that he owns. This week, John will tell us about some of his record hunting trips and the times he found remarkable gems and rare collections. Now, John has been hunting for records for many decades and owns some of the rarest, most sought-after vinyl on the planet. Many of them are the sole surviving copies known in existence. John has also provided some rare blues music for listeners of this podcast. Plus, we'll also be sharing with you how you can get some records yourself. Sundazed Music wants to give away records to Vinyl Guide listeners. Listen to today's episode to learn how you could win some fantastic records. And it's all thanks to our show sponsors, Thorns Turntables. Get one of the best engineered turntables on the market today. Thorns Turntables are high quality and surprisingly affordable. Check out thorns.com. And we're also sponsored by groovewasher.com. You need a record cleaner, and Groovewasher is the best manual record cleaning system on the market. Get yours today at groovewasher.com. And with that, let's start the second in our two-part interview with John Tefteller.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Well, hey everyone, thanks for joining us for yet another episode of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for fans and collectors of vinyl records. Today is the second in our two-part interview with John Tefteller, world-famous record collector and music preservationist. Last week we began the discussion with John, and he spoke about his collection. He gave an overview on some of the collecting shenanigans he's been involved in. It was a great discussion. If you haven't listened, I recommend you go back and hear it before you hear this episode. John has a massive record collection, and he focuses on finding pre-war blues 78s. His collection is very well respected, and many of his pieces are the sole surviving copies of some of these songs. So not only does he hunt and collect these records, he preserves the music. Then he circulates the remastered copies in his yearly Blues Images calendar. It's available at bluesimages.com. And I can't recommend this calendar and CD enough. It's like $23, and it's chock full of extremely rare blues tracks, newly unearthed advertisements or pictures when these records were first released, plus a heap of little factoids about the music and the musicians of the day. It's such a delight. So please, do yourself a favor. Go pick up the calendar and the blues CD from bluesimages.com. So we're about to get into the second half of our discussion with John, but first I got to remind you about our contest, favorite record contest with Sundazed Music. Now, Sundazed Music, you guys know that record label, Sundazed, Sundazed.com. Sundazed wants to give away some of their latest releases to Vinyl Guide listeners, and it's super easy and super fun to enter. Simply take a picture or short video of your favorite record, post it to Instagram or Facebook with the hashtags #VinylGuide and #Sundazed. Now, it's up to you which record you choose. Maybe it's your most collectible record. Maybe it's your most valuable piece of vinyl. Maybe there's a great story around it, like you got it in high school and played it the first time you got to second base with Jenny Shute. Or maybe it's from your dad's record stash, one of his favorite records that you guys enjoyed together. Whatever the story, share it with a picture or video and tag us at Vinyl Guide and #Sundays. And you got to do this before August 26. And if you do this, you may receive a package from Sundazed Music of some of their new releases. Maybe the brilliant jazz guitar of Barney Kessel, or the out there audio of John Cage, maybe the tribal drums of Tak Shindo, or something cool from the new Modern Harmonic label. Head on over to Sundazed.com to see their catalog and vinyl goodness. Sundazed Music, kind of like a record company, but fun and run by music lovers. Okay, let's get to the second part of our interview with super record collector John Tefteller right after this word from Thorns and Groovewasher. The one thing that all record collectors and vinyl enthusiasts have in common are turntables. However, not all turntables are created equal. Do you know that More and more used record stores are starting to warn their customers against those cheapy turntables. Look, it's because cheap turntables can ruin records. And when you invest in records, you want them to last as long as possible and sound as brilliant as possible. And that's why you need a Thorens turntable. Thorens turntables are designed and manufactured in Switzerland and Germany. Wonderful engineering with the sole purpose of ensuring high quality sound. Now, Thorens has turntables for just about any budget, so don't think you need to spend thousands and thousands of dollars. Thorens has a full line of great sounding turntables that will fit into any budget. So check for yourself. Go to Thorens.com, Thorens.com. Check them out for yourselves, read the specs, or ask your hi-fi dealer today. Thorens turntables, quality which you can hear. Groovewasher.com. Look, I love Groovewasher. I can't say enough good stuff about Groovewasher.com. They have an incredible product. Look, we all need to clean our records, right? And Groovewasher, in my opinion, has the best product at the best price point. Groovewasher cleans my records better than any other manual record cleaning system I have ever tried. And believe me, Groovewasher cleans records really to the point of one of those expensive record cleaning machines. You know, the ones that are like $1,000 or $1,500, the ones that all the record shops have? Well, yeah, those are great, but you pay for those, right? Groovewasher will give you that level of clean in your home for less than a tenth of the price. Right now, go to groovewasher.com, check out their cleaning systems today. They have packages that start at $55 shipped within the USA. I actually recommend you check out one of the ones with the extra fluid and maybe the display block. They're not much more, but they're really super handy, especially for those of you who love your records. So don't just take my word for it. Go to groovewasher.com today, check out what they have, and get the one that's right for you. That's groovewasher.com, and they are made in the USA. All right, thanks again, Thorens and Groovewasher, great products which I use and vouch for personally. And now let's head over to the second half of our interview with John Tefteller, super uber record collector, audio preservationist, and all around good guy. So tell me a story or two about some of your favorite unexpected finds.
Well, that's a little hard because I don't have a lot of unexpected finds. The way it tends to work these days, now I have some unexpected ones from years ago, and I'll give you one or two of those, but just so you know how it works these days. These days there's not much unexpected. There is so much knowledge out there in the world available at the stroke of a key on the internet that it is not the case where people just have a hoard of records and have no clue as to what's in it. Everybody's doing their research, everybody's looking things up everywhere they can, and everybody's trying to get as much money for everything they can now as possible. Back in the old days, in quotations, that wasn't the case, and you could go into a place and you would have no clue what was in there. The people who owned it had no clue what was in there, and every once in a while you'd find some really, really great stuff, and it was all priced pretty reasonably back then. The records weren't worth anywhere near what they're worth now, and the price on the street, so to speak, was very reasonable. There's lots of old-time collectors out there, and some of them passed on now, but some of them I still know, and they're still my friends, and they're 10 and 20 and 30 years older than I am, and they tell me all these stories about how they would go into these places, and they'd find these records, and they'd find all these great records, and they'd pull them out, and the people that owned them would tell them, well, I want 10 cents a record, or I want 25 cents a record. And these guys were buying all kinds of incredible stuff for pennies, basically pennies. And even at the time, pennies on the dollar, because this stuff was still worth some money then, not nowhere near what it is now, but still really, really reasonable. And you were, if you were a collector back in that time period and you had any kind of knowledge and any kind of idea about how to find stuff, you could be inundated with mountains of great stuff for little or no money. And that's not the case now. now if you want good stuff, you got to pay for it. And I mean, I don't mind doing that, but I'm just telling you, it's much different.
Is that kind of the eBay phenomenon now? Everybody.
Well, it's not just eBay. It started with price guides. You know, there were no price guides for records until the 70s. And even the early price guides were very specific. They covered a specific genre. They weren't this general book with all this multiples of information in it. So it started with the price guides, and then as the Internet came on in the 90s and all that, and eBay came out and all this, it multiplied itself. But it started pretty much in the mid-70s when the first price guides started coming out. I think I've sidetracked from your initial question, which was...
It's all fascinating. It's fine. It's
tell me about a surprising find, and I will tell you one surprising find, and maybe two, but we'll start with one and see how far we get with that one. I was with my wife. This was about 1984, 1985, something like that, which in record collecting years now, it seems like not that long ago to me, but hey, run the numbers. 1984 to 2016, what's that, 30 years? It's not just yesterday, but it seems like just yesterday to me. We were in Atlanta, Georgia. It was Christmas Day, so we didn't figure we could really go anywhere or do anything, and we were checked into a hotel in Atlanta, and the phone rang. And I didn't have a cell phone back then, but I had a way to be able to get calls. If somebody called my house, I had a way to get it referred to me anyway. And this guy said that he had what he described as a couple hundred records, and was I interested in coming and looking at them? And I said, well, where are you? And he said, well, I'm in Savannah, Georgia. Okay, well, from Atlanta to Savannah is about a 3-4 hour ride. So it wasn't dramatically far from where we were. And I said, well, tell me about these records. And he says, well, I don't know. I used to be a jukebox operator years ago, and this is just a couple hundred records that I have left from when I was a jukebox operator. And I said, okay, so they're 45s. He said, yes. I said, all right. Is it blues, rhythm and blues, rock and roll, country, easy listening? What kind of music is it? He goes, well, my route back then was primarily in the black bars and the juke joints, so I would say it's predominantly blues and rhythm and blues. And I said, all right, well, let me think about this for a second. You're 3.5 hours away. You have 200 records.
And it's Christmas Day.
We have nothing else to do. Let's go check it out. So I would have normally blown something like this off because the quantity was just so low that you figure, oh, you're going to drive 4 hours and it's going to be Dinah Ross and the Supremes and miscellaneous 60s Motown or something like that. It's not going to be really good records. But okay, we're 3-4 hours away. We got nothing else to do. We'll do it. So we drive down to Savannah, Georgia. We get to this guy's house. He opens up the garage door, and we wander in. And he says, well, they're in here. Let me find them. And he's wandering around and wandering around. And he can't find them. I said, oh, great. All the way down here, and he can't find the records. So he looks at me, and he says, well, you know, they were here. I put them out here years ago. I know that nobody's been in this garage. I know that they haven't been stolen. They got to be here somewhere. Well, I thought, well, all right. But he had, you know, junk piled everywhere. And so I noticed as I was wandering, just about to give up, that there seemed to be a pallet with a cover over it. And so I pointed to the pallet, and I said, well, is it possible they're underneath that cover? And he goes, yeah, I guess so. So he walks over, and he pulls the cover off the pallet. Well, there weren't 200 records sitting on that pallet. There were probably 5,000 records sitting on that pallet in boxes. And he said, oh, I guess I have more than I remembered. I was like, okay. So I started opening up the boxes, and the first box I opened had red and orange vinyl Aladdin 45s in it. And anybody that's listening to this that knows what that is going to go, what or my God, or whatever you want to say. They're extraordinarily hard to find. You never, hardly ever see them. And sure enough, this was the first box. So I wound up buying an awful lot of those records. I did not buy them all because some of it was country and some of it was easy listening, and he didn't care what I bought. So I sat there and I went through all of them and I pulled out what I wanted, and we had one of the best surprises of my record collecting career.
So those things are just unexpected. The guy just calls you out of the blue, and then you follow up on your instincts and your hunches as to whether you go out and take a look at it. And sometimes you're surprised, often you're not.
Right. Okay, now here's another one for you. I had a rockabilly record by a guy named Mack Banks on the Fame label, F-A-M-E, from a little town called Houston, Mississippi. And the name of the record is Bebopin' Daddy. And I had found a copy of that record in Memphis, and this would have been in like 1987, 88, somewhere in there. And I was in Memphis, found this record. It said, it had an address on it of Houston, Mississippi. So I took out my trusty map and I looked, and I found Houston, Mississippi was about 2.5-3 hours south and a little bit east of Memphis. So I thought, this is a great record. I played it, and it's a great record. Love to have more of these. Wonder if I took a drive down to Houston, Mississippi, if I could actually find some more copies of this. So I got in my car, drove down. When I pulled into Houston, Mississippi, I realized that what I had suspected was correct. It's a little tiny town, not much of anything anywhere around it. But I saw a radio station tower in the distance, and I thought, well, there's a place to go. The guy that runs that radio station is probably going to know where this record was made and may even know the artist, may know the label owner, may know something. So let's go to the radio station and ask him. So I go driving down this road to following the line of sight to the radio station tower. And sure enough, right near the radio station tower is a building where the radio station itself is. Get out of the car, carrying the record, walk in, and there's a counter as you come in with a girl behind the counter who was maybe 25, 30 years old. And I knew she wouldn't know, but I thought, well, I've got to start somewhere. So I said, hi, and I held out the record, and I said, I'm from out of town. This record on the label here says it was made in Houston, Mississippi, and since we're in Houston, Mississippi, I'd like to know if I could speak to the owner of this radio station or somebody who works here who's been here for quite a while, because I'm trying to find out where this man is that made this record or whether there's more copies available of the record or something like that. And she looks up at me and she says, well, I can tell you this, that record was made right here in the back studio. And I said, okay. Yeah. And she goes, and when my father gets back, he can tell you all about it because he was the one that was the engineer on the session. It's not his label, but it was produced here. He ran the board when they cut it, and he can tell you all about it. And I said, oh, all right, great. She goes, well, have a seat over there, and when he comes in, he'll talk to you. So sure enough, about half an hour later, this old guy comes walking in, and he walks over to her, and she says something to him, and he walks back over to me, and he says, so you're interested in Mack Banks? And I said, well, yeah, it's a great record. I said, you produced this thing? And he says, well, not exactly. He said, I turned on the controls, and I was here when the master was cut, but I wouldn't exactly call it producing. And I said, okay, is Mr. Banks still alive? And he goes, yes. I said, all right. I'm trying to find more copies of this record. And he goes, well, I've got two, but I don't really want to sell mine because I've only got two, and that's kind of like one for me and one for my kids. And it was cut right here, and it's got a sentimental value, so I really don't want to get rid of it. But he said, I can put you in touch with Mack Banks. He may have some copies. I don't know. And I said, okay. Well, I'm looking for all kinds of old records. Since you run a radio station, do you know anybody that's got a bunch of old stuff like this that would be interested in selling it? And he says, well, I've got a whole lot of it, but I'm not interested in selling it. And I said, well, what do you mean a whole lot? And he goes, well, like a whole lot, like 200,000 to 300,000. Oh, any chance I could even see some of it? He goes, yeah, all right, follow me. So we walk through this radio studio, past the control room, past where the guys are on the air playing their country records or whatever they were playing, and he opens up a door, and beyond that door, it looked like a library that would just go on and on and on, with 45s, 78s, LPs, all neatly arranged on shelves and all looking very old. And I said, wow, you do have a lot of records here. And he goes, yep, had them here since we put on the station. We've got all kinds of stuff that came in here. We never threw anything out. We saved and filed every record that came in here. And he said, besides, before I had the station, when I was in college, I collected early country records. So I've got country 78s going back to 1929. I'm like, oh, really? I said, is it okay to look around a little bit? He goes, yeah. He said, I don't want to sell anything, but you can look around. So I'm looking through and just casually trying not to get too excited. And I thought, there's got to be a way to make this happen. I can't walk out of here and leave this stuff here. There's got to be a way to make this happen. So I saw on the end of one shelf was a copy of Dr. Ross on Sun, The Boogie Disease, which is a pretty rare Sun record on original 45. It looked like it was in perfect condition, an original old brown sleeve, and it was just sitting on the end of the shelf. So he was standing right there, and I walked over, and I said, ah, Dr. Ross on Sun, you sure you don't want to sell anything? And he goes, no, I don't want to sell anything. I said, well, how about for $1,000? And he looked at me, and he said, say that again? And I said, $1,000 for this one. And he goes, are you serious? I said, well, I wouldn't say that if I wasn't serious. Yeah, I'll buy this record for $1,000. Can we discuss it? And he goes, discuss it? I don't have to discuss it. You can buy it. I said, okay. Now, can I keep on going? And he's like, well, for what price? And I said, well, what's the bottom line here? I said, they're not all going to be worth $1,000. And he looked at me and he says, well, you know, this is really weird. He says, people have been coming here for 30 years. And they've all wanted to look at my library, and they've all wanted to buy my records. And every one of them that's come in here, when it got down to it, they said, well, I'll buy some records from you, and I'll give you $1 apiece for whatever I want to take. And I told them all no, because I don't want to sell my records for $1 apiece. But if you're going to talk about $1,000, or even you're going to even talk about $20 for a record, hell, you can buy as much of this stuff as you want to buy. And I thought, okay.
You broke the ice.
I'm going to be here for a while. And he says, well, how are you going to pay me? And I said, how do you want to be paid? And he said, cash. And I said, all right. I said, I can get about 20 grand in cash. We can take care of that. But I said, that's only going to make a dent in what I'm going to take out of here. And he looked at me like I was from Mars. He never had anybody talk to him like that. And he goes, well, all right, you stack up what you want, and as long as you're paying me in $100 bills, you can keep stacking them right up. And I made, just so you know, I made 4 or 5 trips back to that radio station because I couldn't buy it all at one time. There's no way. And I didn't want to buy it all, but I mean, I couldn't even take what I wanted out of there without making multiple trips. And I had to get more money, and I had to borrow money. It was a big deal, but it was a gold mine, an absolute literal gold mine of 1950s rock and roll, rockabilly, blues, rhythm and blues. Everything you could imagine from that time period was there. And then he had pre-war 78s on top of it, so it was really fun.
Wow. And that's really inspiring, because I think your reputation is very strong. I think when people hear and speak your name, it is with reverence, because not only do you do the fair deal, just like you just said, you know, you're not a hoodlum roaming trying to pinch records out of poor widows for pennies. However,
no, and that went on a whole lot back in the 60s, 70s, it'll go on anytime anybody can get away with it, but I never wanted to do business like that because I always found that if you treat people like you want to be treated yourself and you treat people fair, not only can you buy what they have, but they're going to turn you on to 10 other people they know that also have things, and it just keeps on going. And so I've always managed to take one deal and turn it into five more by being reasonable with people.
And on top of it, when you get some of these rare recordings, they don't just disappear. You find these records, you clean them up, but then you make them available again. You may pay $20,000 for a record. However, once it's restored, you take that music and you put it back out there. You make it available in things like your yearly calendar, and you make it available on CD so people can actually enjoy it. It's not being hidden away somewhere.
No, and there's a very easy reason and explanation for that. The way I look at this is the younger generations of people do not have a real simple way to be exposed to a lot of this music. I mean, they do now. There's YouTube and there's some stuff you can get on the internet and all that, but with this type of stuff, with the early blues from the 20s and 30s and all that, a lot of that's, some of it's available and a lot of it isn't. Or if it's available, it's in terrible sound. And so I always thought that the way you perpetuate this for the future is you make it available. You get it out there where people can hear it. It's great stuff. So once they hear it, they go, oh, wow, I like that. They may not have the financial ability to collect the original records because they've gotten outrageously expensive, but they like the music. And so you get that out to people. You keep it alive by making it available to future generations. And if all that's going to happen with this stuff is going to be locked in some archive in Washington, D.C., or locked in some place, some record company vault, where it's not worth it to the record company to put it out because there isn't a big amount of sales, how many sales do you think they're going to get on some of this stuff if they actually put it out again? Not much. There'd be a few thousand people that might buy it, but there's not hundreds of thousands or millions like there would be with the latest CD by Adele or whoever the hot person of the moment is. And so the record companies aren't going to mess with it very much. So the way you do it is you put it out there. Now, I do all mine completely legitimately. I'm not bootlegging anything. I get complete permission from the original holders of the rights, and I pay the royalties, and I keep it completely legit. There are plenty of companies out there that do not do that, and they're ripping off everybody in the same way that the old-time record collectors were buying great records for a quarter and telling the people that they were happy to, that they were lucky to be getting that quarter. So it's a whole different way of looking at it, but it gets the stuff out there and keeps it alive. And the way I feel is if I don't do that, and I don't have to be the only one. In fact, I hope I'm not the only one, but I'm one of the few anyway. But if I'm not one of the few that gets this done, it's not going to get done, and then the stuff is just going to vanish and it's going to be thrown away.
Be lost forever.
It's going to be gone because the record companies themselves have an abysmal track history of not saving masters. There's no masters for these pre-war blues records. There's a few. I think Sony in New York has a few for some of the Columbia stuff that have survived the years. But overall, the masters are long gone. There's nothing you can do to retrieve that stuff. It was melted down. It was sold for scrap. It's just gone. And so the only way you can do it is to hunt out one of these commercial pressings that still exists, try to find it in as best possible condition you can, and then spend the time to do the cleanup to make it sound even better than it could if you didn't clean it up and do it properly. So it's a good cleanup. It's not a sloppy job. You spend the time and energy to make it really sound good, and then you put it back out there for people to enjoy. And I've created a following of people that routinely will buy that stuff. And it's not a huge following. I wish it was. I'm trying to figure out a way to make it bigger. But for now, we've got about 5,000 to 7,000 people that will buy one of my releases every year. And that's fine. That's enough to keep us in business. It's not enough to be particularly profitable, but I'm not going at it as a profit-making venture. I'm going at it as a break-even venture that preserves the music for future generations.
What I'd like to do is also recommend to people to check out your website, which is tefteller.com, T-E-F-T-E-L-L-E-R, where they can see this year. It's a yearly calendar.
Then we have to be a little careful there, because okay. tefteller.com is my sales site for records. If you're talking about the calendars and the things associated with the pre-war blues music, that is a different website. It's bluesimages.com. B-L-U-E-S, as in blues, and I-M-A-G-E-S.com, bluesimages.com. We have a yearly calendar. We have all the previous years available, most of them anyway, as calendars, and we also have the CDs that were created to go with them available separately. So if you don't want an old calendar, you don't need to do that. You can just simply get the music. Now, this is difficult to describe. But to your listeners who have never seen one of these things, what it is it's a full-size calendar, a 12x12, so it looks like a record album cover, with original advertisements for the records as when they first came out. And all those original 20s and 30s blues records, when they first came out, an advertisement was created to sell them. And those ads were put in magazines, they were made on posters, they were made on flyers, they were put in books. They were printed advertisements for the releases as they were coming out. And they have really clever artwork on them. Sometimes they have little photos of the singers. And we reproduce one of those for each of the 12 months. In addition to that, in each calendar is a CD. So you get the calendar for each month, and then you get a CD. The CD has the songs, all 12 of them, that are featured in the calendar advertisements. So you can look at the original advertisement and then put on the CD and hear the record that they advertised. Then we fill up the rest of the CD with another 8 to 10 or 12 tracks of super rare records of which there are no ads that have been found, or they are things that are just historically important that I feel like putting on there for people to enjoy. And so you get a full 20 or 24 track CD with each calendar. That's how it works.
So it's fair to say that if your phone rang later today and someone did find that Willie Brown or a J.D. Short record, you would likely purchase it, perhaps for tens of thousands of dollars, have it restored, and it would be on next year's calendar.
Yes. And if we couldn't get it on next year's calendar, it'd be on the year after. It just depends on at what point during the year this amazing discovery that I hope happens occurs. we have two tracks by J.D. Short on the current calendar for 2016, and that was a single copy of a completely battered, broken record that turned up last year. But it was one of the missing J.D. Short Paramount records, and we restored it, and it's on the current 2016 CD. But it depends on when they come in, because we have certain deadlines, and if they come in after that deadline, we still use them, but then they get bumped into the next year. So right now we're working on the 2017, and we have until about May or June. And if we don't find anything like those missing Willie Browns or something, you know, terrific like that, by May or June, then we'll just go with other things that I have here. And I do have some other little treats here that haven't been shared yet. So we will definitely have fun things for the 2017 calendar no matter what. But I would love to be able to have somebody say, oh, look, I found one of those Willie Brown records, and have that be on the 2017 calendar.
So you spend a lot of time scouring the country looking for old records and collections here and there. How have you gone about finding some of the Paramount paraphernalia that is now part of your collection?
Okay, well, the story with that, and this is actually a really interesting story. I was with my relatives in Los Angeles having a Thanksgiving dinner in 2003, my cell phone rang, and it was a friend of mine from New York, and he said, "Have you been looking at eBay lately?" And I said, "Well, I'm on vacation. It's Thanksgiving Day. I'm having dinner with my wife's relatives. No, I'm not looking at eBay today. Why? What am I missing?" So he says, "Well, you better go get yourself a computer, and you better look, because there's something really interesting on there." I said, "What is it?" He said, "Well, it looks like an original advertising poster for a Blind Lemon Jefferson record." And I thought, "Oh, I've never seen anything like that before. That sounds interesting." So sure enough, I got to the computer, I looked at it, and I went, "Wow, is that cool." And the seller was in Port Washington, Wisconsin, which is where Paramount was from, because they identify on eBay where the sellers are from, or they used to anyway. And so I jotted off a little note to the seller, and I said, "I saw this on eBay. I'm going to make a nice bid to acquire it. Just have a question for you. You're in Port Washington, Wisconsin, which is where all these Paramount materials were. Do you have any more things that look like this?" And I waited about 20 minutes, and a response bounced back that said, "How many would you like?" With a question mark. And I wrote another message back, and I said, "We need to have a phone conversation. Here's my phone number. Please call me. Or if you don't want to make a long-distance call, send me your phone number, and I'll call you." Well, sure enough, he called me a little while later. And I said, "What is all this?" And he said, "Well, this is part of a collection that I have that was found in an abandoned building in Port Washington, Wisconsin. The building used to have the Port Washington Herald newspaper offices in it." Well, the Port Washington Herald was the local newspaper that was going at the time Paramount Records was going. And he said that they used to have their offices in this building that it had been long abandoned, but that he worked for a newspaper in Port Washington that had bought the building, and they were going to move their equipment in there and reestablish it as a printing area for a newspaper in Port Washington. And he said he was told to go into the building and empty out anything to make way for all the stuff they were going to move in there. And he said, "I found a couple file cabinets that were still sitting there after 70, 80 years. They'd been sitting in this building." And he said, "I opened up the file drawers, and I'm looking, and here's all these posters and pictures and advertising plates and all this stuff. And it was all related to this record company called Paramount," which he said I'd never heard of, but he said the stuff looked really cool. So he said, "I have a partner that was sent over there with me, and she took half of the material, and I took the other half, and we divided it." And he said, "I've got my half." He said, "I don't know what happened to her half, but I've got my half." And I said, "So how many do you think you have?" And he says, "Well, I think I have a couple thousand." And I'm like, "A couple thousand?" And this was incredible to me. This was just like, what? I'd never seen one of these things before. Now all of a sudden, here's somebody on the other end of the phone telling me they have a couple thousand of them. So I said, "Can you send me some images?" So he gets out his camera and he starts clicking away, and I'm getting this stuff coming down the computer, and it was just astonishing looking stuff. I'm like, "This is amazing." I called him and I said, "I want all of this." And he goes, "Well, okay, fine, we can work that out." And I said, "And I want to know where your partner is." And he says, "Well, I'm a writer for the paper, and she was the photographer. We're not married or anything, and we never were. She was married to somebody else, but they had a nasty divorce a few years back, and she left the area, and I don't know what she did with that stuff." And I said, "Find her. You've got contacts in the newspaper industry. You can figure out where this woman went. Find her." And he goes, "Well, I know she went to the Denver area. Yeah, give me some time. I'll try to come up with a name for you or whatever, come up with her contact information."
So after a conversation like that, can you sleep very well?
No. It was insane. So anyway, so he a couple of weeks later, he finds her address and phone number in Colorado, calls her up and says that some guy out in Oregon is interested in buying his material. Do you still have it? And she tells him, I don't know. So I get this phone call from him where he says, well, I've got her phone number for you, but she doesn't know what became of all that material. And I said, oh, no. I said, well, I'll call her. So I called her. And I got her on the phone, and she said, look, when I moved out of Port Washington, it was a messy divorce. I took some stuff with me, some stuff I threw in the garbage can, and some stuff I left at my parents' house. She goes, I don't know where this stuff is. She goes, I know what you're looking for. I remember it. I remember it was really cool-looking old blues advertisements and all that, so I know right what you want. I just don't know where it is. And I said, well, can you find out? Can you, like, call your parents? Can you find out where that stuff could be? Well, she spent about 3 weeks. She calls me on the phone. She says, I found it. It's here in Denver. It was in my garage. And I said, okay. Look, I said, I want to buy it. How do we work this out? And she goes, well, you're buying all of Steve's stuff. That was the other guy. And I said, yes. And she says, all right, well, look, I haven't been home to Port Washington for a while. Give me a good excuse to go there. I'll gather up the boxes I have, and I'll get them to Port Washington, and you can meet me there, and you can buy his and mine at the same time, and we can all have lunch together. I'm like, okay. So that's how that came about. But once I knew that in 3 weeks or so I was going to Port Washington, Wisconsin, to put this Paramount Files collection back together, I thought, what an opportunity. I've never been to the area before. Maybe I should do something special. So I took out a full-page ad in the local newspaper, which helped, of course, the guy that I was buying the stuff from, because he got his ad commission on top of it, I guess. Sure. But anyway, I took out an ad there. I sent out flyers through the post office. I printed 13,000 flyers and had them mailed at a cost of about 12 cents a piece to every household within 100 miles of that city. And it basically was a flyer with pictures of some of this advertising material on it, pictures of Paramount Records, and a big thing that said, reward, thousands of dollars for this type of material. Please call me. I'm coming to town from out of town. So I sent this stuff out. I pulled into a hotel in Port Washington. I had my calls forwarded from Oregon, and I sat there, and the phone rang off the hook with people who had parents, grandparents, relatives who had worked at the Paramount pressing plant and had a ad or a record or a something related to the company. And I sat there for 2.5-3 weeks going methodically through all of those leads until I had exhausted all of them. And then I went back a year later and did the same thing all over again. But the second run didn't produce anywhere near as much as the first run, because I actually became like a sensation in the town, because here's this guy coming in from Oregon with thousands of dollars to buy all this stuff that they thought was nothing, that belonged to their parents or belonged to their grandparents. So they put me on the TV, they put me on the radio, they had me interviewed for the paper, they put it on the front page of the Milwaukee Journal that I had come up there to do all this, and it just fed upon itself and resulted in all kinds of more fun things that I got to buy besides this whole collection of Paramount Files.
And within those Paramount Files, you got not only the pictures of Blind Blake, but for the first time, people got to see the entire person of Charlie Patton.
Yeah, that was the big icing on all of the cake, because when I first started talking to the first guy, he said to me, he said, well, you know, I've got pictures too. It's not just advertisements. He says, there weren't a lot of pictures in those files, but there's some. He said, I know I've got Blind Blake, and I know I've got Blind Lemon Jefferson, and I've got a couple gospel quartets. And he said, I've got a picture of Charlie Patton. And I said, say that again? He said, well, I've got a picture of Charlie Patton. And I said, okay, is it a headshot? Or is it something else? Because there was a known headshot of Charlie Patton that had been used on all kinds of things since the 60s when it was found on some flyer in Georgia. He said, no, it's not a headshot. He's sitting in a chair playing a guitar. And I said, what? He said, yeah, he's sitting in a chair playing a guitar. And I said, and you have this? And he goes, well, I think so. if I don't have it, Janet has it. And this is, of course, when I didn't even know if Janet could find her copies of her stuff or whether it had been destroyed. And I said, if you don't have it, Janet has it? And he said, yeah, well, one of us has it. He's sitting in a chair. He's playing a guitar. And I said, oh, no. What is this? It's there, but it's not there. He saw it, but it was destroyed because she got a divorce and dumped the stuff in the garbage. I had sleepless nights for multiple nights until I actually got to Port Washington, and he laid out all the material for me. He had it all laid out when I walked in the door, and she was there, and she had her material all laid out in another room. And I walked in, and I'm looking through all this stuff, and sure enough, here is this picture of Patton sitting in a chair playing a guitar. And that was it. And then when I looked at her stuff, she did not have the same thing he did, but she had the same photo, except that her photo was on the front cover of the 1929 Paramount Dealers calendar. And that was the inspiration for me doing calendars, because I saw that as like Paramount put out a dealer's calendar for their dealers in apparently in 28, 29, and 30. The only one that's ever surfaced is this one from 1929 with Patton on the cover. I don't know who they put on the cover of 1928, and I don't know who they put on the cover of 1930, but in 1929 they put Charlie Patton on the cover, and they saved that in their files. And it's the same photograph that he had a separate print of. This was a print used on the front of this calendar. Mm. And so that when I saw that, I thought, well, this is fabulous. I have two copies of the same print that no one had ever seen before. And one of them's on the front cover of a calendar. So what a cool idea it might be to make a blues calendar in 2004 and use that same image on the front cover. And that's what I did to release it to the world.
Wow, that is an incredible story. And John, I got to say, it's been an absolute pleasure hearing about your experience. You're a detective and you're a collector, and you're doing it with integrity. And sharing this music with people after you've spent time seeking it out, and then your money, of course, investing in it, and then restoring it, and then to share it with listeners and hopefully inspire a new generation with this music is really very remarkable and admirable.
Well, that's very nice of you to say that. Thank you. I like being appreciated. It is a lot of hard work. It sounds very simple the way I present it here in this interview, but it's a lot of time, it's a lot of energy, it's a lot of money, and it's a lot of fun on top of it. So yeah, I like doing it, and I'm not planning on stopping.
and that's great, and we're very glad you said that. I just want to do a couple of plugs for you real quick, if that's all right. I want to encourage people to head over to bluesimages.com, and there they could not only get this calendar that you talk about, they can get past years. Each calendar comes with a CD of these rare tracks. But they can also get copies of these posters by these Blind Lemon Jefferson posters, Blind Blake, the Charlie Patton images that you purchased. They could buy these images, posters for themselves.
Yes, I've reproduced some of the major images, and they're available as posters. We have T-shirts with some of the images on them, and then we have all the CDs and calendars. And everything is very reasonably priced. I'm not out to gouge people. The calendars are reasonably priced. The CDs are like $10. I mean, we're not trying to gouge people here. We're trying to make the stuff available in as large and wide of a way as we can.
So I want to encourage the listeners to head over to Blues Images and see what you're doing. Pick up a calendar or two, pick up a T-shirt, and really check this stuff out because it really is a piece of history. And, John, I really want to thank you again for preserving it for everyone.
Oh, you're very welcome, Nate. Thanks for taking the time to do the interview. I always have fun doing these things, and I always like spreading the gospel of all of this stuff in that way.
All right, John, thanks. We do appreciate it, and I'm going to let you go so you could free up your phone line, and hopefully someone's going to call with those Willie Brown and J.D. Short records.
I hope so. Thank you, Nate.
All right, big thanks out to John for spending time with us and sharing his stories and his expertise and all he's done for the vinyl collecting community. And now, again, just like last week, John has agreed to share yet another rare blues song with Vinyl Guide listeners. On last week's episode, John shared a track from Blind Willie Johnson called When the War Was On, which is a fabulous song and featured on the 2016 Blues Images CD and calendar, available at bluesimages.com. This week's song is another song off that compilation by a guy named Sparkplug Smith. And we can only call him Sparkplug Smith because to this day, nobody knows his real name. This blues artist recorded this track, Vampire Women, on January 6, 1933 in New York City for Melotone Records, a record label whose tagline is Melotone Records, the best and latest in race records. So Sparkplug Smith steps into a recording studio in New York City on January 6, 1933 and records this song, Vampire Women, which came out catalog number M12654. Now, after that, the artist Sparkplug Smith was never heard from again, and his identity still remains a mystery. But fortunately for all of us, he's part of the 2016 bluesimages.com CD and calendar with a full-page advertisement from the period, complete with a picture of this mystery musician. Again, I highly recommend ordering the bluesimages.com CD and calendar. It's like $23 for both an audio and a history lesson all in one. So again, thanks to the restoration efforts of John Tefteller, we could now enjoy songs like this one. Here's Sparkplug Smith from January 6, 1933 with Vampire Women.
Now, vampire women, they taking the day, causing all these married men to go astray. You can see them standing each and every day, waiting for some vamp to come their way. She'll ask him for five, he'll give her ten. Says if that ain't enough, mama, call around again. Now he'll go stone crazy and he'll go stone wild, go home and mistreat his wife and his child. Now married men, that's not right. Go home and treat your own wife right. For if you dress your wife like you do the women in the street, believe me, you'll have a vampire too, running around here messing with every single woman you meet. That will never do. Says you wake up some of these mornings, she'll be feeling bad. She'll give you the biggest black eye that you've ever had. Just dress your wife like do the women in the street. Believe me, you'll have a vampire too, I mean. Believe me, you'll have a vampire too. Women in the street, believe you'll have a vampire too. Now running around your mess with every single woman you meet, that will never do. Now you wake up some of these mornings, another mule in your stall. Vampire women gonna be the cause it all. Dress your wife like you do the women in the street. Believe you'll have a vampire too.
All right, and there we go. Another episode of The Vinyl Guide down. Make sure, if you haven't heard part one of the interview with John Tefteller, go back and check out that episode, as well as all our other episodes, our entire back catalog. We're getting a lot of episodes now. Go to thevinylguide.com. You can see a whole list of the episodes there. Make sure you subscribe. I know some of you are listening to it online through your browsers, and that's great. There's buttons inside the website where if you got an iPhone or an Android device, just go ahead and click to subscribe so you never miss a future episode. Also, don't forget to enter the Sunday's Favorite Record Contest. Take a picture, short video of your favorite record, post it on Instagram or Facebook with the hashtag VinylGuide and Sundays, and tell us why it's your favorite record, and you may receive a package of records from Sunday's Music. All right, that's it for us. We'll be back with another episode next week. Until then, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. Until next time, keep spinning.